Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Last week, you know, I need to apologize to the group. I made a statement that I would be printing out the four-step forms, and I don't remember anything. And I remembered something once, but I forgot it. I'll try to remember this week, and hopefully we'll have some then. But anyway, we finished up how it works, the chapter how it works, and we're going to be moving into action. Now, just as a brief recap, what we've covered so far is we've basically covered the first four steps. There's a lot of material in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, from the forewords to the doctor's opinion, more about alcoholism, there is a solution. Almost all of that information is designed basically to give you, as a potential alcoholic, to give you the information you need to decide whether or not you are an alcoholic. You know, it's very important to be able to identify as an alcoholic. If you're going to get busy with the recovery part of this program, if you're going to motivate up and actually start doing some work, they believed back in the beginning, and I certainly believe today, that you need to be convinced that you're in real trouble. And understanding what alcoholism is basically understanding that you're in real trouble. Alcohol has the capacity to take you out in a very, very miserable way. Alcoholics go out in very, very pathetic ways. It's not a good illness. It's not a good progressively fatal illness to have. Cancer is much more merciful. It'll allow you the dignity of putting your affairs in order before you check out. Alcoholism does not. You usually go out at the absolute lowest point in your life, where the people that are still around your orbit either hate you or pity you, you know, and it's just not a good way to go out. So finding out whether or not you're an alcoholic is an important thing. They go over basically three categories. One of them is the mental obsession. Can you, when you honestly want to, give up drinking entirely? And many of us fool ourselves, and we believe. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to in treatment centers. I've had treatment commitments, you know, since 1991. I've had treatment center commitments, and they're always and forever telling me, "Well, this time I understand that I really can't drink, so everything will be fine. I know that I can't drink." And then when I see them back in rehab 6 months later, they're like, "Well, no, this time I really know that I really can't drink, and I'm convinced." This, you idiot. You know, powerlessness is powerlessness. You don't play a part in the decision to put alcohol back in your body if you're an alcoholic. You know what I mean? That's what alcoholism is. That's what the first 50 pages of the book is designed to teach us, is that if we are alcoholic, we don't have power, choice, and control over alcohol. We can't predict when we put it in our body. We're, you know, there's examples in the book where you're banging the bar, asking yourself, "How the hell could I have gotten drunk again, knowing that I'm going to end up in the booby hatch?" You know, well, give me a double. You know, it's like, it's crazy. It's insanity. The second part of the first step is the physical craving, the allergy to alcohol. And that's pretty easy to describe. That's one drink always does something, and what it does is ask for the second drink. The second drink insists on the third, and the third demands the fourth. The more alcohol in your body, the more you want more alcohol, because it's a physical craving. The chemical, the alcohol, actually sets in motion a desire, almost unsatiable desire for more alcohol. I used to come to on the floor and get up off the floor and look, and I had just poured a gigantic drink. You know, it would have been like a pint of whiskey or vodka in a giant 16-ounce glass. You know, and all the froth is on top because the ice had melted. You know, it was nasty. But why in the world? I'm this close to passing out in my chair. Why would I pour like another pint of vodka into a glass. It's that physical craving. You want more. And toward the end, not every time, but toward the end of your drinking, you usually drink yourself into unconsciousness. It becomes a habit. Now, if those two things weren't bad enough, you know, the only two problems you really have are when you're not drinking and when you're drinking. And if it wasn't for those two problems, you'd probably be okay. But it's even worse than that, because there's a dash. It says dash that our lives have become unmanageable. And what does that look like? What that looks like is on a good day, without alcohol, I'm not talking about when you're drunk, when you're sober, because it's sobriety that's untenable to us as alcoholics. We hate being sober. So on a good day, you're restless, irritable, and discontented. On a regular middle-of-the-road day, you're prey to misery, depression, self-centered fear, anxiety, guilt, shame, remorse. You know, you're totally depressed. That's a normal day. A bad day is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's when we take our own lives, or you know, we end up in mental hospitals or something. We just can't go on. There's no despair like alcoholic despair, and I think most of us in here have touched that, and we don't want to go back, and that's why we're sitting in here, you know, when the Giants are playing, you know, we're in a meeting, you know, because we're serious about not going back there. Then it talks about the second step, the chapter we agnostics softens up the agnostic. And an agnostic is basically agnosticism, as it relates to Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe is simply this. You don't believe God can take you from where you are to a better place in a certain area of your life. So you're not trusting and relying upon God with your love life, or you're not trusting and relying upon God with your work or your family situation. You know, that's why the chapter says we agnostics. It doesn't say the chapter to the agnostic, because we all have this agnosticism in certain areas of our life. It doesn't mean we don't believe in God. As 99% of the people that show up in Alcoholics Anonymous have some idea of a concept of God deep within us. We just do, from childhood or whatever. We just don't believe God is going to do anything for us. You know, we believe that the door has been closed, and that's agnosticism as it relates to this book. So the chapter We Agnostic is designed to soften us up to the God idea. You know, the spiritual idea. We need to have an open mind on this, because our spiritual life, the living and practice of our spiritual life, is going to be our treatment for alcoholism, and it's going to be the treatment for the unmanageability in our lives. And we're going to need to engage in it to be able to survive alcoholism. And to do that, we have to be open to these spiritual concepts to be able to grow. So step two is basically saying, you know, you're going to come to believe that there's a power greater than yourself. And I think we talked about a couple of weeks ago about, if you look at all the descriptions of God in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll be pretty surprised. It's a very, very new agey almost description of God. It's not a God that's a noun. It's a God that's a verb. It's a power. It's not a person or a deity. It's a power. And I think we all can get involved with this kind of thing. No matter what our concept of God is, we can all experience the power of God when we apply these spiritual principles to our lives. Things happen. The first thing that will happen is marvelous coincidences will start. You know, I think we've all gone through the period of marvelous coincidences. But even greater than that, you know, we will find that God can do for us what we can't do for ourselves. We'll find new power in our lives to do the right thing, to be better family members, to be better employees, to be better employers, to be better fellowship members. All this power begins to work in us and through us as we start to apply the steps in our life. And in step three, it's basically just, are you in or are you out? You know, are you going to make a decision to seek this power, you know, through these steps? Or do you have another way? Because the book Alcoholics Anonymous is very liberal. If you've got another way that you want to try, if you want to do primal scream therapy and and medication maintenance, go for it. Have at it. We're here. The Alcoholics Anonymous program really is here for not only the people that want it, not only the people that need it, but really the people who will do it. That's really what the AA program is here for. So in step three, we make a decision to do it, to actually move through the rest of these steps. So often we get wrong beliefs about these steps. We believe that saying the third step prayer is doing the third step. The third step prayer is an affirmation prayer. When you say that third step prayer, hopefully you've already decided to move forward with the spiritual way of life. And the third step prayer is affirming that decision. And then we moved into into how it works, which was there was a great body of work in the chapter How It Works. There's an outline of the steps. There's descriptions of the alcoholic personality and the untreated alcoholic and their behavior. Basically, the actor that wants to run the whole show. Selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of your troubles. You step on the toes of your fellows and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation. And there's a whole body of work in there that really explains why we have had hard going at life, why we've had defective relationships, why we've not been able to move forward in our lives, why we haven't been successful in certain areas of our life. And it explains all of that. And then it asks us to do an inventory, and to do an inventory of what's going on in our lives. Many of us have been asked this question somewhere in our drinking career. What is wrong with you? I can't tell you how many people asked me that after I did some bizarre, crazy thing in a drunken stupor. What is wrong with you? Or I just got a DUI and I'm at the liquor store the next night, in my car. They're like, what is wrong with you? And I didn't know. And we don't know. We go to our grave not understanding alcoholism. Sometimes the people who drink themselves to death usually drink themselves to death not even knowing what the problem is. So what the inventory is the inventory is designed to show you exactly what your problem is. What's your problem? Your problems are basically resentments, fears, and conduct. All of that distorted way of living that the alcoholic exhibits is all wrapped up in our anger, our fear, and our conduct. That's the whole Megillah. So in this particular inventory, it asks us to look through all of this. Now, last week we went over sex and fear. The week before that we went over resentments. It's important to be able to effectively write inventory. Folks, if you haven't learned how to do the four-column resentment, the two or four-column fear, and the nine questions in conduct and sex conduct, if you've not learned how to do that, you're at a great disadvantage. And your survivability is going to be impacted by not having that, being able to do those exercises, because you're still going to be wandering around not knowing what the problem is. You'll be working on the wrong problem. You'll be trying to stay sober one day at a time instead of helping work with God on the repair of your spiritual condition so that the problem will be removed. Alcoholics Anonymous is about removing the problem. It's not about fighting off a drink. It's about having the problem removed. It's not about struggling to maintain your sobriety the rest of your life. It's about being placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. But there's a body of work that has to happen before we get to that part. So tonight we're gonna start on the chapter into action. You know, I thought we got a lot of action done when we were doing our inventory, but every time you do a step, it tells you, yeah, you did okay, but you know, now it's time to really get to work. And this is a chapter basically where it has us doing that. Chapter 6, into action. Having made your personal inventory, what shall you do about it? You have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with your Creator, and to discover the obstacles in your path. You have admitted certain defects. You have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. You have put your finger on the weak items in your personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. That is one of the most amazing promises in this book. We've just inventoried everything that's wrong with us. And this promise here is basically promising that it's about to be, these problems are about to be cast out. You know, I don't even to this day understand this particular promise. It's not 100% manifested in my life, but I believe these promises in this book. I believe that they do materialize when we work for them. But this is an unbelievable promise. It's basically saying our problems are going to be cast out. Our problems are going to be over. This requires action on your part, which when completed will mean you have admitted to God, to yourself, and to another human being the exact nature of your defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. So what we're supposed to do is, and I got this wrong early on, I went to a treatment center where they had you do a life story. Anybody ever been in a treatment center where they had you do a life story?
No.
Okay. They also had you do another thing that was very interesting, group. Anybody ever been in group in treatment centers? There you go. That was interesting as well. Now, a life story is a very valuable exercise. You go back through your life, you know, and you look at the things that you've done wrong. And then what I did was I really thought my first fifth step, I really thought it was sharing my life story with somebody. Because that's what the treatment center basically, you know, alluded to me that it would be. So my first fifth step was a confessional fifth step. It was basically reading my life story to my sponsor. Now, the thing that's different between an Alcoholics Anonymous inventory being read at a fifth step and a life story being read at a fifth step is when you read your life story, you don't learn anything new. You wrote it. You know it all. The thing about when you share a fourth step, a big book four step with a sponsor, I don't know anybody who hasn't opened up, you know, during that fifth step and started to realize more about what was going on in their life. You know, your ego cracks open sometimes like an eggshell when you do this. You're reading about all your resentments. You're reading about your fears. You're reading about your harms to others. And something just happens when you're sharing this with someone who understands, like a sponsor or a spiritual advisor. Something just happens and there's a change. I didn't have a very great change with my confessional reading of my life story, but when I first read my inventories, my resentment, my fear, and my conduct inventories to somebody, I walked out of there changed. I walked out of there about as right size as I ever will be. You know, humility, my favorite definition of humility is an accurate self-appraisal. You don't think you're better than you are, and you don't think you're worse than you are. You have an accurate self-appraisal. And walking out of this fifth step, I had an accurate self-appraisal. I wasn't some scumbag, but you know, I had work to do. You know, I had to stop being spiritually lazy, and I had to start moving forward with the rest of these steps. And it was a very profitable experience for me. You know, much, much greater benefit than something that would be confessional. So this fifth step is perhaps difficult, especially discussing your defects with another person. Now, notice, in this book, it doesn't say that you're going to get drunk or you're going to fail very often. Notice how many times it basically alludes to, if you skimp on this step, you're going to be in deep trouble. Just notice how many times it says that. You think you have done well enough admitting these things to yourself, perhaps. We doubt that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. We strenuously urge you to go much further. But you will be more reconciled to discussing yourself with another person if we offer good reasons why you should do so. The best reason first. If you skip this vital step, you may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep themselves to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. So the alcoholic, and remember, not everybody that comes to AA these days are the low bottom alcoholic that this book is describing. But the important thing is this is a treatment for low bottom alcoholism. If you don't have low bottom alcoholism, the treatment's still going to work. It's probably going to work better. So, but it basically says here that time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their life, trying to avoid this humbling experience that have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. So it's important. It's important to know that if you do hold things back, or you do say to yourself, listen, I don't mind going to the meetings, I don't mind making the coffee, but they told me a long time ago never to admit to anything, even if they got you on video. If you hold on to old ideas like that, you may not survive alcoholism. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. The answer is they've never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egotism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. You know, there's a power that you can get by fully laying out all these inventories in front of somebody. It's basically sharing with somebody everything that's wrong with you. Now, if you do that as a spiritual exercise, it's going to take the wind out of the sails of this stuff that leads to your lack of self-esteem or your belief systems about you, being a scumbag. I mean, until I started to do this stuff, I really thought I was a scumbag. And after going through some of these exercises, I started to come out of that, and I started to think, I'm a run of the mill alcoholic is what I am, and that's better than being really what I thought I was. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think of someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes that they will never see the light of day. He's under constant fear and tension. This makes for more drinking. This is the vicious cycle. I was a hard liquor, blackout drinking maniac. And I would do stuff in these blackouts that I was horrified by. Some of them were stupid. I'll give you for instance, I was a drunken dialer. Anybody in here do the drunken dialing, and blackouts? Oh my God. It got to the point where I would start drinking and I knew I was going to head for the phone. So I would cut the phone lines. I would. I go down in the basement, I cut the phone lines. But I was an electrician. So I'd get drunk and I'd get feeling like I want to talk to somebody, and I'd go and I'd tape the lines back in. So it got to the point where I was cutting it at the knot hole. I even threw a ladder up on the side of the house and cut it way up by the electrical wires as far. But I started drinking, I found like a milk crate, put the ladder up another couple of feet and put it back together. Well, it got so bad that you couldn't even hear on the phone. There was so much static. So we had to call the phone company, and the phone guy comes, and he's looking. I'm standing there with him, and he's looking. He's going, "What the hell?" He goes, "It looks like somebody cut the phone line in like 25 places and scotch taped it back together. You know? And I didn't want to look stupid, so I'm like, yeah, that's what I thought it was, too. You know? We should probably fix that, you know? Oh, man. But that's just like, that was the tip of the iceberg. You know, some of the crazy things that I would do, you know, like at Christmas parties or something. Oh, my God. I'd be doing great at a job until the Christmas party, you know? It was and you can't think about this stuff because it's so shaming, you know? You're like, oh, God, you know, you want to kill yourself. So what do? You start drinking more, and that causes more of that behavior. It's just nuts, and it's absolutely tragic. Psychologists agree with us. Members of our group have spent thousands of dollars for examinations by psychologists and psychiatrists. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. How many of you out there have spent $100 or $200 an hour to lie to a therapist? Yeah, what a waste of money. Yeah, they're treating the wrong problem when you're not being honest with them. You know, and every once in a while they ask you, do you drink? Well, I have a couple. Yeah, a couple, you know. You're sucking down like 13 bottles of wine every night and you're depressed. You know, so what do? You know, they think, oh, he's only having a couple. Maybe he's got clinical depression. Maybe I should lewd him up, you know? And so we get all lewded up. And now we're like, ugh. What happened to me was they put me on Xanax. Because I went to the doctor one time, and I go, I'm nervous. I'm in the morning. I'm you know, noises. And he goes, and he takes his stethoscope, and he listens to my heart. And he goes, oh my God. He goes, you've got a protracted mitral valve. I think it's been brought on by acute anxiety. And I'm like, sounds good, doc. You got anything for that? You know? And he goes, yeah, we got this new drug. It's called Xanax. I go, well, what kind of milligrammages does that come in, doc? I'm gonna need the big ones. And it was only a couple months later when I'm weighing them in my hand. You know, I'm eating like 15 at a time and drinking them down with vodka and just. Man, that noodles you when you do that, okay? You don't have a sober breath in your body. And so I was misdiagnosed, you know? And it was not the doctor's fault. You know, I was suffering from DTs when I went to him. It wasn't anxiety. It was delirium tremens, you know? But do you drink? Well, not really, you know? I just have two 28-ounce, you know, bourbons every night as well. So... Oh my God! We have seldom told them the whole truth. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder the medical profession has a low opinion of alcoholics and their chances for recovery. Here's interesting. I'm going to tell this story and then I'm going to turn it over to Dave. I go to the Cape Cod Symposium on Addictive Disorders and a number of other things throughout the year where treatment professionals come in. And I learn a lot of these things. You know, I learn a lot about what doesn't work is basically what I learn. But there was a study done, and this study was done with medical professionals. And the study started with first-year interns, first-year medical residents, all the way through to, you know, a third-year resident doctor. So it's about a 5-year, 6 years worth of doctors working in hospitals. And the questions were about, do you feel compassion about alcoholics? Do you want to help alcoholics? You know, what do you think about alcoholics? Now, the first-year interns are basically, I want to help the alcoholics. I love the alcoholics. I want to... By the third-year residents, they're like, keep those son of a bitches away from me. I hate those scumbags. They shouldn't be coming into the hospital with regular sick people because they're doing it to themselves. There's a complete lack of compassion that's been found in these particular surveys. Because you know what? What do you think the doctors see on Saturday night? You think they see the recovered alcoholics, happy, joyous, and free? I don't think so. They see the alcoholics that are punching the nurses and vomiting on the surgeons and, you know, being really belligerent and yelling and screaming. And they see that every single week. And you know what? They're tired of it. You know what I mean? They're tired of it. It's we are not easy to work with. right here.
I've never seen anybody make dying sound so funny. Didn't you have an experience with a Morristown surgeon who made a special trip to your bedside?
Yeah, that I was killed. And it got worse after that, though. Let me tell you, alcoholism always gets worse. I got killed in a car accident. I drove through a telephone pole. And when the ambulance and the cops got there, I had no pulse and I wasn't breathing. And they brought me back with the CPR. And then in the ambulance, I flatlined again. And they had to hit me with the Hooters, clear. And I came back to life. And I can you know hazy recollections. You remember I remember being strapped down, being operated on, screaming and yelling. And they couldn't give me any anesthesia because I was so drunk. And so I'm like spitting and hollering and yelling, and he's trying to sew my head closed, and my ribs are broken. Well, I wake up in the ICU the next day, like not remembering much of this, and the doctor made a special visit in, okay, just to say hi. He goes, you know what? He goes, this hospital actually has a policy where we don't give the police blood specimens for a DUI if someone's really hurt. We just don't do it. But in your case, I wanted to make an exception. You disgust me. And I'm like, thanks. Thanks for sharing. And I had my buddy, sneaking drugs in because I'm not going to be sober if I'm in a hospital. I'm not going to be straight. But it was a mess. And this guy just saw me is not even worth sewing up. And that's the way we are. That's why I think it's so important for us to have commitments in hospitals and treatment centers and detoxes and to go to court sometimes to find. I mean, we need to be letting these professionals know that treatment is available and recovery is possible. We do, because all they see is the bad. And they hate us. They hate us. People. You talk to nurses. They don't want to take the Saturday night shift. They're like, "Well, you take the Saturday. I don't want the Saturday night shift." In the ER, because here we come, right?
Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. As a footnote to that story, as soon as he got out, he went to the park and with his buddies to help him out and died.
It's the minute I got out of the hospital after being killed, I went to the liquor store to buy booze to go down to the park to drink and to tell my war story. With my head taped up in my bed. Yeah, I was killed. Drinking and driving. We're the type of people who we don't think about that. We after we've gotten our third DWI, we say to ourselves, I've got to stop driving. what I mean? It's like
right there. One of the few people I know who should be the before and after picture of AA members. The fifth step is supposed to be this wonderful experience where I finally get reconciled with what the truth is in my life. And where I finally get reconciled with the way the world looks around me, because I've done all this work with a sponsor, with God, with a pen and some paper, and I've uncovered the things that are ailing me and are causing me a separation. I always read that the people who had a successful fifth step experience would feel this great freedom afterwards, and they'd feel alive for the first time. And that was not my experience. What happens if you come to AA and you got things you can't talk about? Right? What happens if you show up here with a few notches on your belt? What happens if you think that the things that you've done are too horrendous to ever speak of? I mean, what happens if you spent a lost weekend with your buddy on a farm having sex with farm animals, And you're just not going to share that with Bob, the accountant from Summit, Well, there was this sheep one time. What happens if the worst thing that you can think of in your life pales in comparison to what you hear in the rooms, and somehow you think you're going to be less than if that's all you have to share? You know, I came in here with a bevy of, you know, I mean, if life were fair, I would have been charged with several federal crimes. You know, when I came in here, I had things that the statute of limitations hadn't run out on and wouldn't for many years. You know, and I didn't trust y'all. You know, I really didn't. I didn't believe that coming in here and finally getting honest with the guy who had 11 more days than me and was still had about 14 voices in his head, you know, was going to somehow bring me closer to God. I had made this philosophical decision, this intellectual decision that just this process was somehow flawed for me, but it was fine for you. You know, it would be years later when the evidence would be overwhelming. This was a sad state of affairs for me because, just as Chris so aptly described, it's not enough to come here and hang out with you guys. Just isn't enough. I need to have a reconciling. I need to get. And here's the funny thing. I used to berate the fist step because I'm going to make an admission to God. Well, if God's so powerful, He knows exactly what I've done already. Ha ha ha! Right? What do I have to tell Him for? Right. What I didn't realize that it was a humbling process that I was about to go through. It was about getting right with the world, finally admitting, you know. And I never even really looked at that part, which is the first part, right? That I'm going to admit to God, to myself, and to another human being. It's just not something that I was willing to do. And the other thing that seemed to strike home for me was, you know, in the inventory process, I'm supposed to be getting a handle on what ails me. I'm supposed to be getting some sort of idea of where my failures are. I'm supposed to be getting some sort of idea what the roadmap looks like in my life. You know, where the enemy lies. Right? So for once, I'm going to have some intelligence. Because I knew coming in here that there was a lot of things that were wrong with me. And I couldn't quite put my finger on them, and that was too much work to do anyway. But in the fourth step, I get an opportunity to put my finger on these things, and I start to get a roadmap of what this looks like. You know, what I'm facing. It's like, imagine if you're going into battle with another nation, but you have absolutely no idea where their army is. You have absolutely no idea where their tanks are. You have absolutely no idea what troop numbers are. You have no idea. It's going to be a difficult battle to win, isn't it? Without the information, it's a difficult battle. Here's the crazy thing. I didn't have an opportunity to have a real fist-step experience until I realized that the enemy did not exist. That the opposing army did not exist. That the opposing army was me. And there was nothing to do battle with. You know? And in the fifth step and getting honest and being humble, I would have this opportunity to be free of me for the very first time. There was no tanks waiting over the hill. There was no, you know, secret snipers in the bushes. There was nothing there that was going to attack me. Right? It was me all along. And it was the things that I did. And I've got to have those things. If I don't have those things, I'm not an alcoholic. Right? I've got to have those things because my delusion requires them. I've got to come up with every reason in the world to protect me from the truth. Because given the truth, right, I will recognize the fallacy of my life and I will recognize the shortcomings. I will recognize how I'm harming others and how I've been harming myself all along and that all these things are self-derived and self will run right. My delusion has to keep me from that, so it presents in such a way that there's always somebody out there who's over the hill. There's something out there that's gonna cause me a problem. And the first time I sat down with a sponsor to do a fist step, I went in. It was like a Tuesday night, and I went into my office to meet with him. And it was dark, and it was in the spring, so the sun set early. And we sat there, and I told him every single disgusting thing. The statute of limitations had run out on everything, right? That I could think of. And even if it hadn't, I was still going to be honest. Because I had no other place to go at this point. And I walked out of there completely void of any feeling. I did not have any sort of wonderful experience. I did not have any sort of amazing turnover in my life. My life didn't get rocketed into the fourth dimension. I left there absolutely, undeniably positive. I was one of those constitutionally incapable people. I walked out of there knowing that I was somehow broken in a way that you guys wouldn't understand, and I didn't even understand. I knew that I was not going to have your experience. I knew that it was over, that this was a failure of epic magnitude in my life, and I might as well trudge the road to the end, not to a happy destiny. Funny thing was, the next morning when I was cutting through the Trinity Church graveyard, because my building, what separated me from where I worked, and I worked on the floor of the American Stock Exchange, was the Trinity Church graveyard in Lower Manhattan. And my office was on one side, and I cut through every day. And I was cutting through that churchyard that morning on my way to work, where I'd had a tremendous amount of ego at play. I had a tremendous amount of my character defects were at play, day in, day out. I thought they were what defined me as a smart businessman, right? If I don't have my character defects, who am I? Right? And I'm walking through that graveyard, and I suddenly physically feel lighter in my shoes. And the first thought that goes through my mind is, I have a brain aneurysm. I honestly believe something had snapped. I'm like, oh, this is awkward, right? But what I realized, and that was the truth, and what I realized though was I was walking into a building where my character defects had defined me as a traitor, as an employer, as a guy on the floor, you know? You know, I was. You probably have all seen the movie Trading Places, where they're all in the pit screaming and yelling and everything else. That's what I did for a living, and I was the most. I tried to be the most aggressive, obnoxious person you could ever meet. Perfect alcoholic, right? And that's what I did. And I was walking into that building, and I suddenly knew that these were failed strategies in life, and everything changed at that moment. But I didn't have the experience that they talk about, that Bill Wilson talks about in the 12 and 12, and I certainly didn't have this freeing moment at the end of the disclosure. Right, of all the things. And my sponsor had done very similar things to me. My sponsor had actions in his life, and he shared with me. Because I found out that the fifth step wasn't just about me talking. It was about me sharing with another human being what it was. And I started to find out that he felt the same way about a lot of things in life, and he had the similar experiences. And I saw him as being free. You know, and he didn't have anything special. But he had that AA smile, you know, where you think they have brain damage, but they're just happy. And this guy was just alive. He was alive, and he didn't have any money in the bank, and his wife had left him, and he had a special needs kid, and he was just taking care of what he had to take care of. And he was alive. And he didn't have the things that I thought you needed to have to be alive. And it kind of blew my mind, and he shared with me the things that he had done, and it became a very special moment later on in life. And I would do other fifth steps later on in life, and each one of these would take on a new experience for me and allow me to get closer to God, because I was able to identify and move away from self. So just for those of you who may have walked in tonight for the first time, we're doing the original manuscript. So if we're reading things and you go, that's not in the book, it's because it's not in the book. You must be entirely honest with somebody if you expect to live long or happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, you are going to think well before you choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. If you belong to a religious denomination which requires confession, you must, and of course will, want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Though you have no religious connection, you may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. You will often find such a person quick to see and understand your problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter ministers who do not understand alcoholics. Anybody here ever go to an ordained religious individual to do any part of your fifth step? A couple of hands, right? You know, I always thought it was a good idea. But what I found for myself, that what I do is I go to the ordained religious people and I ask them questions about what I've uncovered in the fifth step, right? Because there's something of the nature of me sharing with another alcoholic, and it's going to be my sponsor typically in the fifth step, right? Something about sharing with you guys the horror show that was my life run on self-will, because I can hear back from you the story of your life running self-will, right? And I haven't heard a lot of priests or nuns or anybody else talk about, you know, carrying a gun into Harlem and you know, doing these things. Although I guess if I wait long enough, I probably will. If you cannot or would not rather not do this, search your acquaintance for a closed-mouth, understanding friend. Perhaps your doctor or your psychologist will be the person. It may be one of your own family, but you should not disclose anything to your wife or your parents, which will hurt them and make them unhappy. You have no right to save your own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of your story you should tell to someone who will understand, yet be unaffected. The rule is you must be hard on yourself, but always considerate of others. Notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing yourself with someone, it may be that you are so situated that there is no suitable person available. If that is so, you may postpone this step. Only, however, if you hold yourself in complete readiness to go through it within the first opportunity. We say this because you are very anxious that you talk to the right person. It is important that he be able to keep a confidence, that he fully understand and approve what you are driving at, that he will not try to change your plan, but don't use this as a mere excuse to postpone. Anybody here ever go to prison? Anybody here want to go to prison? I work with some guys. I have worked with some guys who were in prison at the time that we were communicating through a letter exchange process. And I took one guy through his fifth step on a letter exchange process. And I'm scheduled to take another guy through his fifth step in a letter exchange process. And I don't know if you guys know this, but they read your letters. So that's a very tough proposition, isn't it? What do you do in that case? Right? What do you do? I don't know. I've never been behind bars. I've only been on the outside listening. Other than that, there's very few times, I think, in today's world that someone can find one of us. Right? I'm very fortunate in that I do a big book workshop with some people in Italy and Spain over Skype. And over Skype, you can do whatever you want, right? I mean, it's almost face-to-face. It's about as close as we can get. And over Skype, we have these wonderful discussions, and we talk about it. But if you live in certain parts of this world, there are no effective, literature-based meetings. There are no effective places to go out and seek out somebody who you can have a one-on-one conversation with unless you seek the religious ordained person. There are many places in this world where AA has not found its way in any other manner than we're going to have a meeting, we're going to sit around, drink coffee, and talk about how our day was. And this is one of the things that surprised me when I started doing this with these people, was that in Europe, in populated regions of Europe, there is no literature-based meetings. AA has traveled across this world, but the literature-based concept and the desire to do literature-based recovery, actually doing the steps, hasn't traveled as far or as deep as the idea that we have a fellowship and it's successful. Other than that, I've never really had the problem of narrowing down the people that I might want to tell my story to, I want to tell my inventory list to. You know, there's always somebody around here. We should really look upon the fact that we live here and know that they're within a stone's throw. We can find somebody who has a message of depth and weight that we can sit across and do this inventory. It's not always true. When you decide who is to hear your story, we waste no time. Have a written inventory. Be prepared for a long talk. Explain to your partner what you are about to do and why you have to do it. He should realize that you are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approaching this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by your confidence. Pocket your pride and go to it. Illuminate every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once you have taken this step, withholding nothing, you will be delighted. You can look the world in the eye. You can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Your fears will fall from you. You will begin to feel the nearness of your Creator. You have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now you will begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will come strongly. You will know you are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Who here has heard of the promises? Right? These are the fifth step promises. Who here has ever thought about the fifth step promises? There are a couple of people raising their hand. Shyly, not even wanting to be separated from the crowd. Raise your hand high if you've heard of the fifth step promises. There you go. How cool is that? Nowhere does it say that I'm limited to the things that occur after the ninth step. Each and every gift that I'm given is given along the lines of being available to me when I do a little bit more work. Not hang out a little bit longer. Not be with you people a little bit longer. Not share funny stories of doctors berating me the next morning in the ICU. You know?
Judgmental professionals.
I know, judgmental. Where does he get the wherewithal to do that, right? each and every time I come across one of these, I have to take a moment to look at it. Is it true in my life? Have these promises come true in my life? Once you have taken this step, withholding nothing, you will be delighted. Is that true?
Yes.
Yes.
You can look the world in the eye. Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
You can be alone at perfect peace and ease.
Yes.
How cool is that? I mean, considering how many voices I had in my head when I walked through these doors. Your fears will fall from you.
Yes.
Okay. You will begin to feel the nearness of your Creator.
Yes.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? Is it possible for the first time I'm actually closer to my Creator? Is it? You know, it's funny. When I think about this, I don't think the distance between my Creator and I has ever changed. From the moment that I was born to the moment that I sit before you, I think the distance has always been there. What I've done is put up window shades. What I've done is thrown mud on the window. What I've done is do all this stuff, right? That turns that light off because it's too much and it doesn't align itself with my delusion. So as I do this step, I start to open the window shades, I start to wash the windows off, and it appears as though my Creator is nearer to me. But the truth is, my Creator has never left me, right? What do you think I do? Summon them back? You know, come over here. I want to talk to you for a minute. You know, I'm now spiritually free. I'd like you to help me out. That's not the case for me. You know, the case is that I've been kept safe and protected all along, or else I wouldn't be here today. Right? But it appears to me now, because I finally started to get humble, I started to admit that I am the problem in this situation, it appears to me that my Creator is nearer to me. You may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now you will begin to have a spiritual experience. What's the difference between that? What's the difference between having spiritual beliefs and spiritual experiences? Right? One of the great gifts I got was I had an opportunity to work with an ordained religious member. I heard his fist step, and he knew more about religion than I think I will ever know. If I devote the rest of my life to study. First off, my memory's bad at my age, but this guy had spent his entire life up until that point. He was in his 40s. Understood his religion better than I think, you know, you could ever want to understand a single thing. But that knowledge didn't solve his problem, did it? Because he's sitting there doing a fist step with a dope fiend from, you know, Elizabeth, New Jersey. Right? He's sitting there getting humble with me. What happens for me is that I can take whatever knowledge I have of where I've been, the Sunday schools I went to, the books I read, but I start to understand, I start to put a connection to the power that is God in my life and the feeling that I'm going to be kept safe and protected. And it's when I begin to feel safe and protected. You ever heard the guy talk about the pink cloud when you walk in here? Mm-hmm. You walk in here broken, and you look around, and you hear Bob talk about the car accident, and Sally talk about the third rehab, but now she's got 2 years, and she's sponsoring five people and doing the inventory, right? And you get a little hope, right? For me, that's a nearness to my Creator. I start to get a little closer. I start to have a spiritual experience because I start to see the manifestation of what this world looks like when not covered up with self-will. Right, that's an experience for me. I believe for myself that through a series of spiritual experiences, I begin to be awakened. I move closer to being awakened. I don't think, and some people say the exact opposite or in a different way. For me, it's a matter of this slow maturing, right, and hearing this thing. Every once in a while, you see it happen. You see somebody come alive. You see somebody who walked in here yellow like a school bus and dying of alcoholism. The wife has left. The car is gone. The house is gone. The job is gone. And 3 years later, he's dragging people to meetings, and he's doing the work, and he's come alive. And the wife hasn't come back, which is probably a good thing. But, you know, a lot of other things have happened. And I start to have the experience that God works in mysterious ways. And I start to have that experience in my own life. What she says doesn't bother me as much anymore. What they do doesn't bother me as much anymore. where those things would drive me over the cliff. And that's why the broken shoelace drives us over the cliff. That's why the broken shoelace is the thing that takes me out, right? Because I'm so far from being spiritually awake. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will come strongly. And that's a promise that's different than that's in the book. It will say will often come strongly. Here it's said emphatically that it will come strongly. Has that happened in your life?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
You will know you are on the broad highway, being in fact, once again, saying you will know this, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. How cool is that? What kind of great awakening is that? Okay, so here's some directions. When you listen to a fifth step, right, and you force yourself to stay awake throughout the whole process, and at the end of it, you know, or during the process, you're supposed to have some pithy things to say and be able to bring out instances where I've had a similar experience and the things that have been shown to me that have occurred. So while I'm listening to your fifth step, I'm listening for the things that have occurred in my life. I'm listening for how lust caused these problems. I'm listening to how financial insecurity has caused these problems. I'm listening for the way that ego has manifested and caused a problem here. And I'm sharing with you along the way, you know, if you're willing to hear it, the things that have happened to me that are similar to you. Because I want you to know that you're not alone in this. I want you to know that what you're saying to me is not foreign to me, that it's what's happened to me. At the end of this process, you know, one of the things that I always do is I always make sure I ask this question. I ask it several times. Is there anything you left out? How convenient is it for me not want to mention that weekend at the farm, right? How convenient is it for me to not want to talk about that money I stole from the mother or whatever else I might have done, you know, the cheating or the whatever the things are. Because I don't think that you'll understand. I don't have any belief. I don't have any faith. Chris was talking about agnosticism. I have current agnosticism. I'm going to give God 98.7% of what I got. The other 1.3%, I got that, God. I don't have to give you all that. You want? Try to guess where problems come up in my life. 1.3%, right? It's my current agnosticism, but when I'm going into my fifth step, I have these things I just don't want to talk about because I don't want to be different. You know, I finally have a little hope. I don't want to be different. So the question that I ask, and I ask it repeatedly, is have you left anything out? Is there something else that you want to share with me? Have you forgotten anything? It's okay if you've forgotten stuff. You know, I listened to a guy's fifth step one time. It was like 4.5 hours, and I asked him that question probably 7 times. And I said, are we done? He goes, we're done. So just want to ask you one more time, is there anything you left out? He goes, well, there is this one thing. And it was the one thing that he should have told me from the start. You know, when I did my fist up with Chris, I grabbed him. He wasn't even out of his car yet. And I said, I want you to hear this. I did this. And it was the worst thing I'd ever done. He goes, oh, we can get through that. Well, thank God, because otherwise
I don't even remember what it is.
I know, that's perfect. Pick the old
That's
guy
perfect.
For sponsor. Yeah. He'll never remember.
The guy with memory issues.
But it was in giving up that thing that was the hardest thing. But what's going to happen next? Right? In the fifth step, we've gotten humble, we've gotten honest, finally we've talked about everything that we've written, all the things that have happened. Okay, that's great. But what's going to happen next? Well, the directions are in the big book. So when you're sponsoring somebody, or you're doing it yourself, here are the directions. Return home and find a place where you can be quiet for an hour. Carefully review what you have done. Thank God from the bottom of your heart that you know Him better. Take this book down from your shelf and turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully read the first 5 proposals and ask if you have omitted anything, for you are building an arch through which you will walk a free man at last. Is your part of the work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have you skimped on the cement you have put into the foundation? Have you tried to make mortar without sand? What are we talking about here? What are they talking about with all these building materials? Right? What are we talking about? What's the cement that binds us? Right? What's the cement that binds us in this process?
First 3 steps.
It's part of it. Karen?
Sure.
Oh, let me put you on the spot.
You did. You put me on the spot.
Sure. Who?
The truth.
Honesty.
Tell them the truth.
Never tell me the truth. I don't want to hear it.
The truth.
What is the sand?
The lie.
Well, the sand for me is the faith that I put into the process. Have I tried to make mortar without faith? Am I going to bring these things together without faith? The concept that I cannot do this by myself. It says to me right here in this paragraph, somewhere, that thank God from the bottom of your heart you know him better. It's not that I know me better. It's not that I know you better. It's not that I've finally done some work. It's that I know him better. And I know him better because I've gotten humble with my life. Right? I've got faith. I've got truth. These things are out there. Right? They're no longer a part of it. Have I done this in its complete entirety? It asks us to take an hour, to be quiet for an hour, to take this book down from the shelf, to read the first five proposals and see if these things are true in our life. Are these things true? Only I'm going to know at that point. And I will tell you this, motives don't matter, right? It's willingness and honesty. I was incapable of being thoroughly honest my first pass through the inventory because I had no idea what honesty was. I did my absolute best. And that's why a guy like me is going to go through inventory more than once. I don't have a choice, right? And each time, I learn just how dishonest I am last time. Every time you ask me, I'm going to tell you, I'm not in the middle of the road. I cross the road. And then someone will share something deep, and I'll go, oh crap, I'm in the middle of the road. If you can answer to your satisfaction, look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are you now perfectly willing to let God remove from you all the things which you have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, everyone? If you yet cling to something you will not let go, ask God to help you. Ask God to help you be willing. So now we're going to come to the 7-step prayer. When you are ready, say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. You have then completed step 7. It's a pretty short paragraph, isn't it? It's a short 2 paragraphs to cover 6 and 7, isn't it? Right? There's just not much to it. And it was the biggest hurdle. It was the biggest hurdle for me, and I thought that it was going to be a life-ending hurdle. When was I ever going to be entirely willing? The only thing I was ever entirely willing to do was to drink. I was entirely willing to do that at any cost. I was entirely willing to defend my ego at any cost. You know, there was a time where a guy wanted to leave my company because he got a better offer from somebody. So I gave him a huge raise so he would stay, because my ego wouldn't allow him to leave. And when that job offer went away, I fired him.
Awesome.
I'm not driven by self-will much. I mean, I was never entirely willing to do anything. It was only in the desperation of coming here and the desperation of recognizing just how damaged goods I was. Or at least the way that I thought of myself was damaged goods. I really wasn't damaged goods. But just how damaged I was, how separated I was. But I became willing. I became as willing as only the desperate could, as only the dying can. Right? I did whatever I could at that moment to the best of my ability to get free. And I remember thinking, this is goofy. This is crazy. I'm going to get down on my hands and knees, right, and say this prayer, what's that going to do for me? You know? Because even then, at that moment, I still had a level of agnosticism about what God could and could not do. But I was willing because I had no other place to go, because I knew it was over, and I knew that I had no chance. And I think we'll stop here. and open it up for questions.